The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski, in Florence.
And me, Jemima Kish, in London.
This week on the show, we're looking at the role and impact of venture capital on the tech scene here in the UK and the wider connection to the European startup scene. In a world dominated by the US, we ask if the UK or the EU could or should create a Twitter. And with IPOs in the air, we hear from Zoopla co-founder and CEO Alex Chesterman on why his property location app has managed to grow during one of the worst property and economic downturns in recent history. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Alongside Jemima Kish, head of technology at The Guardian, we'll be joined by Michael Jackson, partner at the contrarian VC group, Mangrove Capital. But first, Jemima, we were at the All-Star Awards a couple of weeks ago. Tell us what they are.
Well, they've been around for 11 years. They were founded by GP Bullhound, which is a fairly active tech VC based in London. And it's a very good measure of, I suppose, the atmosphere in the investment community, not just in the UK, but in Europe. There's 700 VCs. The awards are a bonus, but it's always about the event with these things. And so when you have 700 investors and maybe just a couple of entrepreneurs in a very large room with a lot of alcohol, the atmosphere is always going to be fairly upbeat. But there was a real positivity this year about the progress, about the status and about the success of European startups.
So you say that the awards themselves, you know, here's a gong for best entrepreneur, here's a gong for best VC. They were simply a sort of an excuse to get people together.
Even when you work in technology, it's being surrounded by a network of people that you have good relationships with that really counts. And for VCs in particular, a big part of the skill is about mentoring and about having the right networks to support the companies that you find. So it's a massively important event for that.
Was there a lot of money there? Did you get the sense that there was some good inroads for some of the smaller startups?
It's not really an event where a smaller startup or where entrepreneurs could pitch to VCs. It's a little bit more sophisticated than that. It's much more subtle. So it's about having those connections in place. I think this is an event where there's a lot of posturing going on among the VCs and also some sort of subtle recognition of who has had the really big successes, who's managed to spot the trends and the consumer demand, and who's done a good job of mentoring talent.
Well, fantastic, Jemima. Before we discuss the All-Star Awards and the amazing array of tech folks that you met, I first spoke to Michael Jackson, former CEO at Skype and now a partner at Mangrove Capital Partners, which focuses on Europe and emerging markets. First up, I asked Michael, how is the current investment climate now compared with before 2008? So how much money is there now versus then? And where is the money going versus where was it going then?
The 2008 climate was, if we mean around the time of the crisis, there was, of course, very little money around and people were pulling back in general. There was basically a dearth of finance. There were some opportunities there and they were probably around things, more definite projects, things like e-commerce, for example, where people are selling things online, very understandable business model. People were prepared to invest in that. And I think now we're seeing people being a little bit more adventurous, investing into different kinds of projects, the sort of projects that we like, you know, risky projects and things like that.
A lot of the boom around mobile and around apps in particular has been the creativity, giving people a platform, giving people a launch pad, and also giving people the tools to simply create new and outstanding pieces of technology. Now, we saw the All-Star Awards and conference in London about a week ago. And, of course, the first TechCrunch Disrupt conference is happening in Berlin at the end of October. Is the UK and the EU, are they seeing a real sort of creative and economic upturn?
Yeah, absolutely they are. I mean, the EU's always been a creative area. Europe's always been a very creative area, as we know, and we're seeing that coming through onto the internet. If we look at the games companies, for example, many of them are European. Some of the biggest franchises have come out of Europe. As we know, the film industry, aside from the Hollywood side, there's a lot of creativity come from European film industry. And all of that creative talent is now being directed towards the internet. There's an awful lot of stuff happening there, I think. The economic upturn is there. I mean, as we know, internet businesses, in fact, don't require a massive amount of capital to get going. That's one of the good things about them. So, you know, that helps a lot, is you don't need hundreds of millions to at least get started on the net. So we're there. But I think we are. And I think people have a great tendency to compare Europe with America, or to compare Berlin with London and all of these things. And I think that's, to some extent, not justified. The ability for a small group of people to grow a global business happens. I mean, it happened with myself, Mangrove, in the Skype environment, where that was basically started by 6 or 8 or 10 people or something, and grew to be a global player. And there are plenty of others we see, you know, in the Angry Birds, it was just a typical example in the entertainment space, and so on and so on. There are thousands of examples, and there's absolutely no reason that Europe should consider itself in any way inferior.
That was Michael Jackson from Mangrove Capital Partners. Jemima, at the All-Star Awards in London last week, there were several mobile phone startups that our VC guest from earlier in the podcast might want to have a gander at. How well represented was mobile at the event?
There weren't a huge number of companies there. This is more about the investors. But there were some key companies that are incredibly promising that we can talk about shortly. But the Swedes, the Scandinavians more broadly perhaps, had a really noticeable presence at this event. One particular example that I love is a company called Klarna, which is a mobile payment system, which sounds like the dullest thing in the world, but actually the way that they're doing it is incredibly clever. To answer your question about mobile, more specifically, I think mobile is so integral now that people don't really think of it as a separate business proposition. I mean, it has to be absolutely, completely central to most businesses, to most consumer propositions, because it's the critical device that people have with them all the time.
Now, you mentioned Klarna, and Klarna is, I believe, it's a platform that allows for payments, for mobile payments. Tell me a bit more.
Yeah, they have the same penetration as cash and cards in Sweden, which is astonishing. The way they've managed to do it is that when you're kind of there's a bit of a point of pain, I suppose, at the moment. If you go to a website and you have to use PayPal, and there's that login process, and then if you have to enter all your it's a nightmare. What they've done is unified the process across different platforms, so it's a one-click purchase. And the reason they're able to do that is because they already have all of your details, and you don't actually pay at the point at which you buy. They're effectively doing, I suppose, a kind of real-time credit checking on you at that particular point in time. So they'll gather a huge amount of data on you, which is actually more than traditional credit checking agencies gather. And they'll check that at that particular point in time, you do have the money to pay for what you're paying for. But once they've said that you can buy it, you can choose to pay later. And it's quite telling that one of their senior executives used to work in the gambling industry. So this is a business built on risk assessment, effectively.
And you actually spoke with that founder about his background and about Klarna in general.
He's not a founder. He has been there from very early on, but he has a background. He's kind of US and Swedish. His family is split between the US and Sweden, which has been incredibly useful for them in building a network and bringing over talent from Silicon Valley. But yeah, this is Claes Tellman, who heads up communications for them. You've just done your presentation on stage where you're trying to win the best investor-backed company in Europe. So there's huge potential here. There's companies of a tiny scale with brilliant ideas. There's very big companies already making a lot of money. How exactly do you define best?
First of all, I think it's an amazing event to be at and to see, you know, and listen to all those companies who have created a lot of value, a lot of jobs. How do you define best? I think it's really a balance between growing, being profitable, and creating jobs. So that combination is how I would define it.
And your experience, not insignificantly, has been in the gambling industry, and the back end of Klarna is very much about risk assessment, isn't it? So at the point of purchase, rather than somebody actually paying from their bank account, they're effectively being given credit. How much can you tell us about how that works back end?
I can tell you that we put a lot of effort into that and have arguably one of the better risk assessment teams in the world or in Europe at this point, I would say, and that's, you know, it's a main focus for the company, of course. But like I said, you know, making payments really simple online, safe, trustworthy, at the same time assessing the risk and make sure there's very little or no fraud.
It's all about mobile now, obviously. How do you translate the one-click payment system onto mobile?
Okay, mobile is the final frontier of payments, we say at Klarna. And we have launched a new product in Sweden, Finland, and Norway called Klarna Checkout that really has been, you know, doing really amazingly well as far as conversion goes. It's really at the same level as desktop, so that is our main focus to launch that product in more and more markets.
And when can we expect Klarna in the UK? This is a big question, isn't it? You need to break English-speaking markets.
Absolutely, and we're looking at several markets and constantly evaluating, you know, a number of markets. So I'm sure sometime in the future we will be here. The only question is when.
Now, Jemima, you said that it's a really interesting platform in Sweden, and already we've seen mobile payment platforms in Korea for a very long time, notably. How far away are we from mobile payments in the UK?
Regulation seems to be much stickier in the UK, and I'm not sure why this is. I know that the Swedes are very, very good at tackling the kind of problems or the obstacles of regulation and doing it in a very logical way, and they break down the consumer process very well. So if we look at a business like iZettle, it does what Square does in the US. And Square was founded by Jack Dorsey, who's one of the Twitter founders, and has had a huge amount of interest and press. It's a unit you attach to your phone, and it can take credit card payments, and you have to sign a thing on the screen, a kind of electronic signature.
I remember seeing it when I was in the States, and it's permeated to the degree that you will literally see ads everywhere, whether they're on television or whether they're in print. And I was able to use them when I was out there. The process is absolutely seamless. It's like using a chip and pin or another credit card system. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, it's seamless, but they've really benefited from massive promotion. And this is an example of something that they don't do so well in Stockholm, which is promote what they do, because iZettle, which does almost exactly the same thing, also has PIN security. So it's much safer, much more secure. And we've actually been trying this out in the Guardian coffee shop. And it's a beautiful piece of software. You can use it on iPad and iPhone, and I think on Android as well. But the most recent piece of research that I did about mobile payments said that only 1 in 5 people in the UK have tried to buy something on their mobile. By 2020, I think even Visa expects that about 50% of us will have done that. But we need to see some really big retailers, some really big companies and banks adopting and encouraging people to use this technology, because the advantages are significant.
Compared with Klarna, Jemima, the next hopeful that you spoke with at All Stars are much smaller, but they have dreams of going large.
This is a French company that you probably won't have heard of, because they're effectively a white label service. They help musicians and labels and businesses in the music space distribute their product digitally. So they plug everything in the back end, and they're having a significant amount of success and certainly making some money. You were first up on the stage today to present your idea in 10 minutes to a group of investors. So recap that a little and explain to our listeners what Believe Digital does.
Believe Digital is a digital music company. We distribute music from artists that self-produce and help them market and promote their music online. So in the UK, for example, we are about to release new albums by James Vincent McMorrow, for example, where typically we'll distribute the album on iTunes, Spotify, the other services, and help work on all of your marketing promotion plan to make the album known to the fans and to the public.
Who are you competing with, though? You showed some very impressive figures on how much money you're making, but whose lunch are you eating?
We were basically first providing a solution that didn't exist in a lot of markets before we launched. So from that standpoint, we're not directly eating the lunch of something of someone. With the fact that in the digital space has opened up a lot of opportunities now, a lot of developing artists can be online directly when they couldn't get access to CD shops before. So it opens up the market. Obviously, when we compete with talent, we compete with the major labels, with Universal, with Warner, with the others, with a number of advantages that being focused on digital, we think, we eat, we leave digital, which gives us a unique perspective and expertise on that field.
You explained in a very compelling way that very, very quickly the music market is turning from a physical distribution business into a digital distribution business. Can you just describe what percentage, I suppose, what stage the market is at and where it's heading?
Where what we see the most developed digital music market in the world right now is the U.S., with about 70 to 80% of the sales being digital for some artists, 100% of the sales are already digital. In the UK, we think right now it's about two-thirds, around 60 to 70%. The same thing for up-and-coming artists. It's probably going to be higher than this. What we think is the CD will represent only a very small percentage of sales 2 or 3 years down the road, which opens up, which in our view, a lot of opportunities. Obviously, when you are an up-and-coming artist, your music is on Spotify. It's much, much easier to discover the music than if you have to buy £7 CDs. So we think it's going to create a lot of opportunities for artists and probably switch from a world where the music market has been shrinking for the past 12 years to a music market that we'll see grow very significantly in the next 5 to 10 years as more and more people become customers of Apple, Amazon, or subscribers of Spotify or Deezer.
And all of the customers of Apple and Spotify and Deezer, are they ever going to know the name of Believe Digital, or do you not? Do you not need to be a household brand in order to make a considerable amount of money and a really good business?
We don't need to be a household brand, and when you listen to James Vincent McMorrow in the UK, you don't need to know that Believe Digital is behind it. It's what matters to us is really our relationship with the artist, our relationship with a music producer, being able to help them make their music available, market it, promote it, help them find the audiences, but they are the ones, and their music is what needs to find the audience. It's not Believe Digital that needs to find its audience.
That was Dennis Logatari from Believe Digital. Jemima, Believe is a small company now, but surely the service needs an audience. You know, it's going to need a critical mass of producers, of content creators to draw those consumers in.
It does. Music is such a difficult space to make headway in. There's just so much competition. I think Believe in France has got a really good profile now, and obviously the fact that they're even at an event like All Stars shows that they're really trying to push hard around Europe. But it's still a very localized industry. Again, it's probably built on personal networks and personal relationships. And Dennis has been in the music industry for a long time. I think he knows people in that space. And so there's a lot of companies who need kind of digital support, as it were, a bit of hand-holding. But I would question the longevity of that business over a longer period.
Another small company to take the All Stars platform was Medic Animal. Jemima, who are these people? What intrigued you about this company's presentation?
Yes, intriguing would be the word. He kind of pitched it as something between Whole Foods and a sort of veterinary support service for your pets. Do I not sound convinced? I don't know. See what you think.
Yeah, so I think we're a combination of kind of Whole Foods on the human side, in that we're all about healthier nutrition and people taking care of their pets from a preventative way, the way that we take care of ourselves. And then on the kind of medical side, we're kind of a Boots. So all of the stuff that you would need to take care of your pet, but implicitly we're a pharmacy. I mean, we actually are registered as a human pharmacy here in the UK. So the regulatory processes that we go to in terms of our team, our product, and our fulfillment is regulated by the Pharmacy Association of Great Britain.
Well, you're in a difficult space then if what you're trying to do is sort of educate pet owners about the nutrition of their animals, but also trying to sell relatively expensive products to them. How do you pitch that? What kind of devices are you using?
Yeah, well, look, there is definitely a pricing element to our business, which is we actually try and have a market clearing price, a price that's actually fair. So unfortunately, because vets are typically very small, they can't buy in bulk, they don't get any of the massive deals that we get through volume, they can't offer the product at a cheaper price. We can do that, and we actually pass that back to the customer. And in terms of educating, I think that that's probably the most important part. Because unless you understand why, if you have an older dog that you think is just old, but actually probably has arthritis, why it's important to not just give that pet medicine, but also feed it a proper diet, unless you understand that that's an important element in that pet's life and health, you won't want to buy this product. You won't spend money on it. Once you understand that, then it's the difference between, you know, buying genetically engineered meat for us or buying organic meat. You have a choice to make.
How big is this market? How much money are you going to make?
Well, the market right now, in terms of size, is about £9 billion. And that's our addressable market. So that's veterinary products and super premium products that we sell in medicines. But the interesting bit is that this market has a kind of 7 to 20% compliance rate. In other words, someone who buys that product one time when they're at the vet clinic, only of the people that buy it the first time, only 7 to 20% will actually buy it a second time. So when you think about how much more the market could expand in size if people actually knew that this was an important element of taking care of their pets and giving them a long and healthy and happy life, then the market would be between 3 and 5 times that size. Right now, we're the largest in the UK by a factor of about 5, our next biggest competitor, which is an indirect competitor. It's an online pet shop, a public company in Germany. And in continental Europe, we're basically the market leader in the pet health space. We think that how big we can get and how much money we can make out of it is actually going to be a positive side effect of how many pets' lives we can change and impact. That's really the way we try and think about it. And my partner, who's a vet, he left veterinary practice and we started this company together because the idea was that as a vet, you can only impact the animals you see. But with this as a platform, we can impact millions of animals. And that's really, you know, what our goal is. It's a kind of crusade. I don't think we're actually, you know, I was shocked. I don't think we're actually much smaller than, definitely smaller than Rovio, but not much smaller than Klarna. I think it's just a part of people's lives that they haven't thought about in terms of online.
Ivan Ratnick from Medic Animal. Now, Jemima, I can tell immediately that you're not a pet owner.
What do you mean? What do you mean? What are you saying?
You sounded so unskeptical. You so unskeptical? You sounded so skeptical.
Yeah.
But, you know, for somebody like me, I have a dog, I have a cat, and, you know, they are members of my family. And if something goes wrong, then just like if a human member of my family gets ill, then, you know, they go to the doctor and then you use Dr. Google to find out a bit more. So this is like a kind of med plus for people like me.
So you're sold then?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting prospect, but I don't know how unique it is. I was wondering, with your oversight of what's happening in the tech world, if we've reached a stage in the industry where the big platforms have already been established, and now we have companies like this one that are using the platforms just specifically for their specialist services, and those are the ones that are going to start to sell to VCs.
Sometimes when you watch presentations, you know that somebody hasn't been out of business school for very long. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but this was a very compelling presentation from him personally. He's clearly very ambitious, very bright. But there was a sense he'd sort of scoured the map of the business world to find a little niche, which looked like it had fairly impressive and relatively underexplored sort of business opportunities within it. The proposition that he came up with didn't entirely make sense to me, I have to say. It's sort of, he's saying that people need to be educated about the health of their pets and then sold expensive food off the back of it. The two things jarred for me. I just wasn't really convinced, sorry.
And already I'm able to buy any specialist food that, say, my vet recommends. He mentions, of course, that, you know, rather than going to the vet and lugging home a 60-pound bag of incredibly heavy specialist food, I could use his service to buy that food and have it delivered to my door. But I can already do that with other services like Amazon and elsewhere. There is also an interesting thing, a cultural thing, and I don't know if he's looking to go big in Europe, but in the US, the specialist foods require a vet's certificate.
Well, they do have registration, actually. He did make that point that they are sort of medically qualified. But why on earth would you go to a website where you don't have the kind of, you know, you don't have the physical real world relationship with a vet that you trust? This is the benefit that these very expensive specialist food companies have, is that within the context of your vet, you're prepared to pay that money for that food, and you're there at that moment. I'm just not convinced there's quite enough of a need for Medicanimal, but I wish them well.
Finally, Jemima, at All Stars, you spoke with another animal-loving company, Rovio, best known for their interstellar hit, Angry Birds.
Yes, well, they love animals, and as much as they can sort of animate them and make a lot of money out of them. They are a funny patch. They have a very good, there's a very good line of sort of dry Finnish wit that they deploy at this kind of event. There's a whole room of suits and they're in red hoodies, so they really stand out. Rovio is interesting because you might ask why such an established company was at this event, but actually there were a lot of questions being asked about whether they were a one-trick pony. They are hugely successful. Their revenues were about 153 million euros last year, which is not to be sniffed at. But can they tackle the issue of a lot of their users being quite young and kind of graduating and growing up out of Angry Birds? They have been very skillful, but they've also been quite lucky with Angry Birds. And the scale of the popularity of the merchandise is quite phenomenal, actually. You would have to question how long they can keep that up and whether they can replicate it.
Mikko Setala, Executive Vice President, Rovio Entertainment.
You've just given us a very convincing presentation of Rovio and how it's really headed. It's interstellar, in fact. Angry Birds is now in space, as we know, and you've also just launched Angry Birds Toons. How's that going?
Angry Birds Toons is going very, very well. We have just 1 billion mark passed one of these days, so we have 1 billion views on the Toon series we started in March this year.
It's often assumed that Angry Birds is a game for children. Is that right? Judging by the number of people I see playing it on the tube, that's perhaps not quite accurate.
You're absolutely correct. It's not quite right because the typical player is a middle-aged woman.
Are they more likely to spend money on Angry Birds merchandise than children, though? You talked at some length about the extensions of Angry Birds and the number of, I think it's 8,000 products you have, and it was at least 500 licensed agents of products. Is it the middle-aged women that are buying the products, or is it the children?
Well, the actual number of products is 30,000, but the Amazon is carrying something 8,000 of these. And yeah, we have 500 licensees. Well, if we take toys, for example, apparel, they are typical decisions made by parents, grandparents as well. And usually they buy something what they think the children like. So, yes, mothers are making these decisions, very much so.
What about when these children grow up, or even when the parents, you know, get bored when the next Angry Birds comes along? How do you ensure that you have longevity in your brand?
I think if we do our work well, I mean, delighting the fans in the future as well, we'll be around with this one franchise a long time, of course. And then on the other hand, we have this good examples, great companies like Disney and Sanrio with Hello Kitty that has been around for almost 40 years now. So, yeah, yes, it is possible, but we have to do good stuff in the future as well.
Now, the really big date in your diary is the 1st of July 2016, which seems a very long way away, but this is Hollywood we're talking about, so tell us what we can expect.
We're talking about the big screen. We're making that happen the 1st of July 2016, and that's a great weekend because it's a long Independence Day in the U.S., and it's a 100 minutes animation produced by the top guys and girls in Hollywood. So it will be a great experience for us and hopefully for you all as well.
Can you leak any of the plot to us?
No, I'm sorry, I can't, but it will be a huge surprise.
Nico Satala from Rovio. Finally, Jemima, who won at All Stars?
Well, it was no surprise, really, that it was Zoopla. Now, we should be quite happy because this is a London-based firm. I first profiled them back in 2008, actually, when they were just little whippersnappers, I think, with, I don't know, certainly under 10 people in the office. But they've always been very, very aggressive in the property space and very disruptive. Here's what the chief executive, Alex Chesterman, had to tell us. Zoopla is now head-to-head with Rightmove as the UK's biggest online property service. When we first profiled Zoopla in 2008, it had 12 staff, but had already set out its stall as a more data-rich and interactive property service. 5 years on, and Zoopla is teetering on the edge of flotation and has just won the Investor All-Stars Award for the best investor-backed business in Europe. Alex Chesterman is chief executive. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, for those people who haven't needed to buy a house, rent a house, or stalk their neighbour's house online, give us an introduction to Zoopla.
So, Zoopla is a digital media business. We own and operate some of the UK's leading online property brands, Zoopla Prime Location. And essentially, what we do is combine property search with property research so that people can look for their next home, whether they're looking to rent or buy. And we list over 1 million properties for sale in the UK. As well as properties overseas, but also can understand the market better. So we list historic sales prices, current values of every home in the country, local information around neighborhoods and neighbors, and all sorts of interesting stuff to help people conduct both their property search and their research.
So even down actually to the newspaper that your potential neighbors could be reading, where are you pulling all this data from?
Correct. So, you know, the reason we set this business up is because the internet made vast amounts of data readily and freely accessible, but it was all over the internet. And what we wanted to do was create a one-stop shop where people can go and find out everything that is interesting and important in making the key decision about where they want to live and the types of property that are available. So we wanted to have, from the search perspective, whole of market inventory, as many listings as are available in the UK. And from the research perspective, everything that we think is helpful to understand as part of that journey, data on how good the local schools are, and as you say, what the locals read in terms of newspapers.
It seemed that when you started, there was almost some sensitivity around prices. We're British and we're obsessed by property and property prices, obviously. But it seemed such an unusual thing to do at the time, to be so explicit about people's prices. Did you have to work hard to sort of get over people's uneasiness about being that open about
prices?
Well,
just before we launched, the government had made available the historic transaction prices. So that became freely and readily available online. Although a lot of people, when we first tested the market, only one in three adults actually knew that information was available. And that's a relatively important piece of information to have in any negotiation process, to understand how long the person's been there and how much they paid historically.
Well, there's a big gap between the government making the data available and the data being visible.
Sure. So we believe that transparency drives efficiency in any marketplace. So that was the premise for our business, which is we can help drive efficiency both on the consumer side of the business and on the professional side of the business by opening up and making the market more transparent. And that's generally true in almost all marketplaces, that the more transparent they are, the more efficient they are.
There are other innovations that you've introduced. I remember a price sort of heat map that you introduced over the country. So tell us about some of the different technological features you've rolled out.
So on the valuation and pricing side, we've built some proprietary algorithms, which are relatively sophisticated, that allow us to value individual properties, all 27 million residential properties in the UK, instantly, and provide a valuation estimate on them based on the inputs that we get from people and the data that we already have. And then obviously that allows us to aggregate that data at very small geographic levels or at national level to look at pricing and price movements. And we update our information on a daily basis. So we have loads of information and data points coming in. And every day we refresh and update, and the algorithms that are self-learning and so become better and better and more accurate every day with every piece of data that we get.
So the Chancellor should be sitting on your website every day tracking house prices.
Absolutely.
You've made quite a big effort to consolidate the property market. As I said, Rightmove and you are the biggest players in this market, but that wasn't the state of play even a few years ago. Tell us about the other sites that you've been buying up.
Yeah, so when we got into the space in 2008, it was a very crowded market. We've done 10 acquisitions in the last 4 years and really consolidated the market down to two key players, as you say, Rightmove and ourselves. And the downturn over the last 5 or 6 years created a unique opportunity for us to leapfrog and acquire businesses that we otherwise wouldn't have been able to acquire in good time. So we've done a number of acquisitions that have helped us to sort of supplement our organic growth and give us the platform to increase our traffic to the size it is today, our customer base, our inventory, and all sorts of things. And essentially, the two key components of our business are ensuring that we have maximum number of consumer eyeballs, so visitors to the website, and the maximum amount of inventory, so whole of market penetration. And by both our organic growth and the acquisitions have led us to be in that unique position where we have significant scale on both sides.
I know that anecdotally we spend a lot of time looking at property on property sites, and a friend of mine spends quite a lot of time on property sites looking at houses that are probably unrealistic financially, shall we say. How do you balance making proper cash from various revenue streams on your website with the number of people that are just kind of fantasy browsing, flicking through pages and pages of property?
Sure. Well, there are a huge amount of window shoppers. There's no different really to retail. The percentage of people walking past the shop window and glaring in it, as opposed to the ones that actually cross the threshold and go in and put their hand in their pocket, is that's a small percentage of the window shoppers. And property is no different. There are a lot of people who, so if you look at our websites, we attract 40 million visits a month to our websites. Now, there clearly aren't 40 million people in the UK currently actively looking to move, otherwise the entire population will be on the move. So we accept that there's a large number of window shoppers, but they are the future buyers, renters, vendors, landlords, etc. So having them engaged with our service is very beneficial. There's a good percentage of those, but there's also a number of hardcore active home movers who are transacting at any point in time. And they use our site and make inquiries to our estate agents and developers that list their properties on our site. So from a financial perspective, our model is relatively simple, which is, as a media business, estate agents, letting agents and developers pay a fee to advertise all of their properties. It costs them nothing if there are lots of window shoppers. It's the seriously interested ones who pick up the phone and make inquiries that drive the estate agency business.
Every business has to change at various points in its life to adapt to market conditions it hadn't anticipated or to respond to a promising opportunity. How's that been true for Zoopla?
Well, I think at the start, we conceived the business in 2007 and launched it in 2008, so probably not the best time to be launching a property business in the UK, given what happened in late 2008 and 2009. So our sort of original plan that sort of the market was going to continue to be rosy, what happened over the following 2 or 3 years is that actually the property professional market contracted by about 25%, so number of estate agent branches, etc. We've, that We decided, as everybody else was pulling back, that we would push on, and that created a great opportunity for us. And I often say that great businesses are built in the toughest times, and that's certainly true of us. So having come through that and now being at the very sort of start of a recovery, that's great for us, and we're very proud of what we've achieved in 5 years, given that it probably wasn't the best 5 years in the market, and very excited about what we can achieve in the next 5 years, given a tailwind, because we've had a headwind for the last 5 years.
Do you think we're in a property bubble now?
No, I think it's definitely too early to sort of start talking about bubble, and I think that we're recovering. Prices still are only just getting back to levels that they were in before the crash, and I think you have to exclude London from that sort of conversation, because London is a highly unique market with a very limited supply, and yes, it is. Prices are well above what they were 5 years ago, but I don't see that changing. It's like any asset. London property is a trophy asset in high demand from a multinational audience, and the supply is limited. So,
well, even Eric Schmidt was having trouble finding a decent house for 30 million in London, apparently. He couldn't get his foot through the door in time. But there is an issue in London that you have to be so fast with property that maybe you have to secure a viewing even before it goes onto a site like Zoopla.
I'm not sure that's right. There are some properties that are the transactions that are done off market. It's always been that way. But there, we certainly have many tens of thousands of listings of properties available in London, both for rent and for sale. So there is plenty of stock available in London and trading.
In your previous incarnation, you co-founded Love Film.
I did.
What learnings, as the Americans would say, did you take from that business into Zoopla?
A lot of analogies, actually. And the main one is that the sort of the consumer is key, that if you deliver a proposition to the consumer that helps improve their life, then you are onto a good business opportunity. So in the case of Love Film, we looked at the traditional model of having to go to a video store, borrow something for 24 hours, go back again and return it, have a limited selection, have fees and late fees. So it was a poor consumer proposition. And we came at it from the angle of how can we improve this for the consumer? And we did that both in terms of selection, price, and convenience. And exactly the same way with Zoopla, we looked at what the consumer really wanted when they were searching for property and looking to make sense of the property market, and how can we pull all this data that's out there into one place to help the consumer journey, the property journey, better, whether they were buyers, renters, or even what we call stay putters. So you don't have to be transacting to be interested. And as you mentioned earlier, people are obsessed in this country by the price of their house, and rightly so. It's for most people, it's by far their biggest asset. So even if you are, as we call it, a stay putter, you're interested in tracking the value and what's changing in your area and all of those things. So that was the angle we came at it from, which is help consumers to make smarter decisions. And in fact, the strapline of our business is smarter property search, because we want to empower consumers to make better informed decisions.
So that's two extremely impressive businesses in, under 10 years. If you look at poor consumer propositions, poor consumer experiences in other markets, what makes you feel a bit itchy? Where do you think you might have to start? Who are you going to tackle next?
I have my hands more than full at the moment. We've still got a lot on our sort of wish list of things to accomplish at Zoopla. So if and when that time comes, it'll be a while off. And it's not something I'm thinking about at the moment.
There was a room of 600 venture capitalists and investors with a small representation of entrepreneurs at the Natural History Museum recently for the Investor All-Stars Dinner. And you won the prize, as we said earlier, for best investor-backed company in Europe, which is incredibly, given the competition in the room, is quite an award to win. There's a huge amount of speculation that there's going to be a Zoopla IPO in the next 12 to 18 months, and also a lot of pressure on
on the next really big IPOs out of Europe to do really well and to set a really good precedent where other companies have tended to sell out before. What can you tell us about your plans to float?
So first of all, you're absolutely right. The room at the Natural History Museum was full of some great judges of those businesses, but also some equally exciting businesses. So we're thrilled to have won that. And actually, it's one of the awards that we're most proud to have won over the last 5 years, because it was voted on by a large group and a knowledgeable group, and the competition was the type of businesses that we have a great amount of respect for. So that was great. In terms of what's on the horizon for us, there has been a lot of speculation recently in the press. That is pure speculation. We are not looking to do anything except to continue to grow and develop our business and look at further opportunities. So I can't sort of enlighten or throw any light on any imminent event for us. And we really are focused on really building out the business and winning, as we sort of put it, and sort of achieving all the things that we set out to achieve on both the consumer and the customer side of our business.
I can't wait to see what you go and disrupt next. Alex Chesterman from Zoopla, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can see more from All Stars, including the companies that we didn't profile, on Tech Weekly at theguardian.com/technology. That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Jemima Kish and Tech Weekly's producer, Jason Phipps. We'll be back next week with more from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratowski. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you will get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.